KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW Seattle, you're listening to Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Seattle's Sub Pop Records will turn 25 this weekend. The celebration kicks off this evening when the band Mudhoney will perform live on the top of the Space Needle. We're going to get a head start on the anniversary a little later this hour. We'll be talking with the company's co-founder, Jonathan Poneman. Also coming up, what Facebook's new graph program does or doesn't do for you. Republicans in the House of Representatives yesterday came out against a sweeping overhaul of immigration laws. What does that mean for the bipartisan immigration reform bill that the Senate passed earlier this summer? Also coming up, we're going to talk with our 9th Congressional District Representative Adam Smith, who I believe is just about to join us by phone from Washington, D.C. And yes, Representative Smith, are you there?
I am, yes.
Oh, good. Thanks for running in from the floor of the House to talk with us. We appreciate that.
Not a problem.
I want to take you back to yesterday when your Republican colleagues met for a couple of hours to talk about immigration reform. And as I understand it, the consensus was that they really weren't going to pursue it en masse this year.
Yeah, no, the Senate did a heck of a lot of work on a very important issue. But the House Republicans do not seem inclined to support comprehensive immigration reform. Now, what they're going to do going forward is anybody's guess, but they've already said they're not taking up the Senate bill, and they've thus far presented no plan for what they're going to do on it, which is very unfortunate because we have a busted immigration system in this country that needs to be fixed.
As I understand it, it's not a unanimous sentiment among Republicans. There are some who do hope that their party moves forward with this.
Yes, no, that's correct. Just apparently in the House, not enough.
Are there any particular reasons that they cite for opposing this bill?
I mean, look, there is still a very strong conservative part of the Republican Party that basically is hostile to immigration in general. They're certainly hostile to any effort to, give a path to citizenship, a path to legal status for any undocumented workers in this country. And they, despite the fact that we've quadrupled the border security budget, met every border security marker in the last 8 years that was set during the 2006 debate, and the fact that there has been zero net migration from Mexico to the U.S. for the past 2 years, they're still very much opposed to immigration. And their view of immigration is simply, try to take every undocumented worker who's in the country right now, send them home, and lock down the border so that nobody ever comes across without documentation again. And I think that fundamentally misunderstands the benefit that immigration has brought to this country, legal immigration in particular. But we need to fix our legal immigration system. I mean, you've got companies like Microsoft that can't even get their own workers from other countries here, so they open up a shop in Vancouver because Canada will let them in. And that's not an isolated example. You've got Canadian officials down in the U.S. trying to recruit U.S. companies to locate in Canada, in part because they have a better legal immigration system for bringing in workers. So, this is a real business problem, but that's not the perspective of, conservative Republicans like Stephen King and others.
So if the House does not take it up, then despite the fact that the Senate crafted and passed a strongly supported bipartisan bill, immigration reform will go nowhere.
That is correct.
I want to talk about another bill that you and a group of your fellow representatives have introduced. It would allow legal marijuana-related businesses access to the banking system. Can you explain a bit more about this measure?
Absolutely. I mean, the real complication here is, federal law in a whole bunch of different places has any possession or sale of marijuana illegal. And there are many different provisions to ensure that, one of which is that, you can freeze the assets of anybody, working with a bank that's engaged in the business with marijuana. Well, now that the voters of the state of Washington and Colorado have voted to legalize the sale of marijuana in certain limited circumstances, well, you can't set up a business without a bank account. And if the banks are federally prohibited from doing business with people who they know are in the marijuana business, well, then you've got a logical conundrum that's going to stop the effect of the Washington State Initiative from being able to be implemented. So the bill is meant to reflect the will of the Washington State voters that passed that initiative and to allow for its implementation. That's one piece, but there are other pieces of it. But certainly the ability to do business with banks is critical to run any business, even a business that's going to be involved in selling marijuana under the new law.
How likely is it that this measure will make it to the House floor?
Not likely. There's still, Colorado and Washington are still relative outliers. I'm sure the House majority here is somewhat hostile to the notion. But again, for me, this is a state's rights issue. We should respect the laws of the states wherever possible. I think it's been kind of proven that efforts to, aggressively enforce laws against marijuana usage and sale have failed. So if Washington State and Colorado want to try a different approach, I think the Fed should respect that. But it's going to be a difficult haul to get there.
You mentioned states' rights. I know that Governor Inslee has been to Washington, D.C., as have our attorney generals, to try to hammer out what the relationship Washington state's law has to federal law, which says that marijuana is illegal. At this point, has the Justice Department issued any firm guidelines for the state of Washington and for Colorado, for that matter?
They have not. They have been conspicuously silent. I have led the effort here in the House, sent letters to them, made phone calls, reached out directly to the White House, because what we'd like out of the Department of Justice on that is just some, acknowledgement that they will stand down and respect Washington state law. Now, understand, Washington state law doesn't make all sale of marijuana and all possession of marijuana legal. So the Fed would still be able to enforce things that are outside of Washington state law, but they would respect the initiative as passed. The Washington state law now. They have not made that statement. We're going to continue to bug them in the hope that they will.
We're talking with 9th Congressional Representative Adam Smith. And finally, an issue that you've been working on long and hard, whether the administration will finally take some steps that will begin the procedure of closing the Guantanamo detention facility. And I understand there have been some small changes in Senate that will allow the transfer of some of the detainees to go ahead.
Yes, the Senate language and the Senate defense bill that came out of committee greatly reduces the restrictions on the president's ability to transfer inmates from Guantanamo. Because keep in mind, there's 84 inmates at Guantanamo out of the 166. 84 who we have decided, number one, we don't have anything to charge them with, either military commission or Article III court. And number two, they are a very low risk. In other words, these are people that we picked up that we probably shouldn't have picked up in the first place. And they are eligible for transfer back to their home country. But Congress, primarily Republicans, though some Democrats as well, have consistently placed restrictions on those transfers. Now, what the Senate did is they eased those restrictions, and they would allow that transfer. So at least we would get 84, a little over half, of the inmates in Guantanamo back to their home countries and out of the prison. Now, this, has to go to the Senate floor, and then most problematically, it has to go to conference with the House Republicans. I certainly will be right there backing up the Senate in my role as ranking member on the Armed Services Committee. But whether or not Chairman McKeon will be sympathetic to it is a whole other question. But I think there has been a shift in attitude. I think people recognize that simply warehousing 166 people in Guantanamo forever is something that's not sustainable, and we need a better plan.
Well, I know that recently the rapper formerly known as Mos Def, going by Yasin Bey, underwent the kind of force feeding that more than 100 of those detainees are going, and he posted a videotape was posted of him by a human rights organization. It's been widely viewed. Do you think that has any kind of impact on Congress?
Yeah. No, I think it does. Now, keep in mind, I mean, that, as I said, I mentioned the 84, so there are some people who are going through the hunger strike who shouldn't be there. And that's just, I mean, that is a huge stain on the human rights record of our country. Even if we were to close Guantanamo, there are, I believe the number is 41 folks who we are quite confident are dangerous, that we don't want to release, but because of the way they were picked up back in 01 and 02, we don't have the chain of custody and the evidence necessary to prosecute them, either under a military tribunal. So they're basically being held as prisoners of war, as enemy combatants. Even if we transferred them out of Guantanamo and held them in the U.S., which is what I think we should do, and we'd still have a problem with what to do with those 41 inmates, because typically, under law of war, you hold them until the end of hostilities. Well, as has been discussed, what is the end of hostilities in this conflict with al-Qaeda? I mean, we're still in a difficult position with those inmates, but at a minimum, you know, there are so many other inmates down there that simply shouldn't be there, that we should move forward with that. And the force feeding and the hunger strike just makes it all the more apparent, you know, what a human rights crisis this is.
But you do believe that the Obama administration is ready to take some direct action to at least transfer some of these detainees.
And I know there's been some criticism of the Obama administration for not having closed Guantanamo, but the bottom line reason is Congress, led by the House Republicans, has insisted every year since 2010, you know, on placing restrictions that prevent the president from transferring the inmates out of Guantanamo, to make it impossible for him to close it. You know, they will occasionally say, hey, come up with a plan for closing it. Well, how can you come up with a plan when the law says, you know, you can't transfer them? And they attach this law to things like the continuing resolution and the appropriations bills, so that if the president would have to shut down the government, basically, to veto it. There are things Congress is going to need to do to give the president the flexibility to put a plan in place to close Guantanamo.
And you believe that sentiment is moving in that direction?
It's moving. is it moving enough? That's a whole other question. I mean, the House Republicans here seem unable to pass or unwilling to pass just about anything. It's still going to be a tough pull.
Adam Smith represents Washington's 9th Congressional District. Thank you so much for taking time this morning to talk with us.
I appreciate the chance. Thanks.
This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman.
#9:19. Intiman Theater's artistic director Andrew Russell and director Jane Nichols join us to talk about this summer's festival and the theater's strategy for survival in a minute on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Pacific University's School of Education, now offering a master's degree in teacher leadership and hosting an open house on Tuesday, July 16th. More information is available at spu.edu/TLP. Seattle Pacific University, engaging the culture, changing the world.
57 degrees in Seattle and mostly cloudy. Now, the forecast says it's going to be partly sunny this afternoon with a high of 72. Tomorrow, though, mostly cloudy all day with a high of 74. It's 9:20. I'm Bernard Ouellette. Sub Pop Records, the label that helped put Seattle music in a global spotlight, is 25 years old. How has Sub Pop changed over the years? Sub Pop co-founder Jonathan Poneman joins us in 20 minutes.
From 94.9 KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. On Thursdays, we usually take a few minutes to catch up on some of the local arts events. This weekend is the official opening of Intiman Theater's second annual summer festival. Here to talk about the company and the plays on tap and actually the future of the theater itself is Intiman's artistic director, Andrew Russell. Hello.
Hello.
Also with him is Jane Nichols. She's one of the directors of the four plays that are part of the festival, and you are directing Dario Fo's We Won't Pay, We Won't Pay.
I am indeed.
Welcome to Seattle, because I believe this is your directorial debut here.
I did a show for WET, for Washington Ensemble, a couple of months ago, but this is my
debut.
On the big stage.
Yes.
Well, we'll come back and talk about We Won't Pay in just a few minutes. But Andrew, I wanted to talk first about Intimon itself. Last year, you shepherded Intimon through closure, actually. That was a year before last, through fundraising and through reinvention. And I'm curious what that year and a half Cauldron of Fire has taught you and what you brought from it to this year's festival.
Sure, we've learned a lot, I think, practically, philosophically, artistically. It'll definitely be reflected in an audience member's experience at the theater. What we're witnessing as we're in previews is that, boy, these plays are funny and they have levity. They make a strong point, but they also are a delightful departure from being outdoors. Last year we had some darkness, you know, Hedda Gabler, Romeo and Juliet, they don't end happily and nor lively. So I think there is a sense of levity.
So that was a lesson that things had to be funnier?
Well, it is summertime. You know, if I'm going to ask someone to, you know, get off their boat and come indoors, I think it's important that not only do they have a good time and we ask them to think, but, you know, we don't need to, you know, be so heavy-handed in our approach always.
So what are the four plays besides We Won't Pay, We Won't Pay?
Sure, sure, sure. We've got We Won't Pay, which opens this weekend. We've got Trouble in Mind, which is a sharp comedy by Alice Childress. It was written in 1955. Many of our patrons are surprised because it's still as smart and relevant about race and representation today. We have Liz Estrada. We had our first preview last night. It is completely inappropriate and funny in all ways.
And now this is a classic.
It is a classic. Sheila Daniels has repurposed it and readapted it in ways that are 100% relevant, even more raunchy, I think. There are pop songs. There's karaoke. Our young audiences totally get it. And there's a framing device that brings it right up to today. And then we have a new musical, Stew for Silverton, which is about the first openly transgender mayor in America, the mayor of Silverton, Oregon.
This is a play that you're directing, and it's a project that has been on your mind, I think, since before you moved to Seattle.
Yeah, that's true. My first trip to Seattle, I had the pleasure of visiting with Mayor Rasmussen in Silverton and said, can we make your life story into a musical? And he said, sure, I don't know why it's that fabulous, but we'll try. And it's a thrill to finally share that with Seattle audiences. It's quite moving.
Have you directed a musical before?
On a smaller scale, I have, at the Fringe level a couple times. This is my first big go at it, and it's a lot of fun.
Is it the first world premiere musical for you?
Well, it's not the first brand new musical. And it's what's great about the program that we're producing Stew under is that we're going to continue improving it and developing it all the way through closing. The writers are coming back over the course of the run. So it's not technically the world premiere, and our Intimon audiences get to offer feedback, get to be part of the development as we make hopefully a new American musical about an unlikely folk hero.
That's Andrew Russell, the artistic director of Intimon Theater, and sitting patiently is Jane Nichols, who directs We Won't Pay, We Won't Pay. And you, do you want to talk a little bit about this play by Daria Fo?
It is a farce, but it is not a typical farce in that it's not all laughter. It's actually got a social bite to it. And it's got music in it, sometimes impromptu by the actors. It was staged after an actual event in 1974 in Milan and is, again, as relevant today as it was back in the 70s.
What was the event?
The event was that women got so tired of prices in the grocery stores going up and up and up that they decided that they would pay at the cash register just what they felt the product deserved.
Really? How many women did that?
Actually, I think it turned into maybe 200 or 300.
Wow.
So this play starts off with two women who come running into one of their apartments having removed several bags of groceries at a considerable discount from the stores because they were tired of the prices going up.
Now, Jane and Andrew, one thing that is different about this festival than what is normally offered in the Seattle area is that you are working with a repertory group of actors and that these plays are performed in repertory, which means they kind of rotate in and out. So how many actors this year?
There are 23 that are all in at least two. Several are in three.
Of my five actors in We Won't Pay, four of them are in three plays.
So
extraordinary.
What kind of challenges does that pose for you as a director?
I think it's more a challenge for the actors. The actors are so dedicated and so game. They come stumbling into rehearsal exhausted, but they never give up. And that's actually what comedy is all about, too, is that you don't stop. You just keep going. It's a sort of triumph of the human spirit.
So there is an occasion in the middle of We Won't Pay, We Won't Pay that Lysistrata comes out?
Not sure.
Not yet. Knock on wood, not yet.
Yeah. Where they all become one.
They're pretty consistent.
Yeah. No, yeah. They're completely dedicated to preserving the integrity of each show.
And they're lucky to have, I mean, Jane has a very long history of teaching people clowning and comedy and letting them know how comedy actually plays a role in all of our lives. So they've been directly influenced. You can see her her energy on stage, so to speak.
So there's four comedies at Intimon, but let's be serious for just a second, if you would, Andrew, because
sure.
Last year Intimon raised about $1 million up ahead of the festival to make that festival possible. One of the things you did was provide free tickets for all your subscribers of the season the year that the theater closed down, which I mean, I'm not privy to your books, but it strikes me that you didn't have a lot of working capital up ahead of this year's festival.
Sure.
So where are you financially with Intimon right now?
Financially, we are stable and thrilled that we get to put the spotlight on the work on stage. And we offered, I call them honorary tickets, because we were honorarying a purchase that those subscribers made the year before. We met our contributed income goal so that we could move forward for this year. We are already fully in the works fundraising for 2014. And ticket sales seem to be going strong, so we'll learn more as the summer progresses. But this is the first summer where we will complete the cycle of being able to sell tickets and learn how we actually complete our year, so to speak.
Do you have a percentage of tickets that you need to sell to make sure that Intimon lives for a third year?
It's people love the drama. It's never that black and white.
No thermometer in the lobby.
I mean, every day we analyze it and look at where we are against where we're going, and that's smart producing, not a necessarily make or break situation, but a constant what is our path. We're delighted that over half of our festival passes have sold this year. We are offering four different levels of Festival Pass. The benefits are quite great and make the theater more affordable. You can sit in a priority seating section. You can have an unlimited exchanging of tickets. I will totally pitch them because they are very smart. The four shows were built to be together. And having spoken to patrons last night that have seen all four, they round out each other quite nicely. So far, we're really proud. We're thrilled about how things are going on all sides. And we'll see what the next year holds.
Well, so I asked you what you had learned last year over the last year and a half when you went through closure and uncertainty and fundraising and, you know, Phoenix like came back from those ashes. Mission wise, you have changed your offerings for this year, but if you would characterize, you know, where what Intimon is and where it fits into Seattle's theatrical community.
Sure. Intimon Theater produces theater that is relevant to our time and as diverse as the community in which we live.
It's written on a piece of paper.
That is our mission verbatim. I will say it over and over because not only is it, I think, succinct, but it is also a working order, which I think is important. We offer theater in the summertime when there is less theater. We offer a destination point for those living in Seattle and out. It's the only repertory company in Seattle. And we hope that both in our model and in our attitude, it is refreshing and delightful summer fare.
And will you continue? I mean, is it your plan at this point to continue with this repertory format?
Yeah, we love it. Our audiences seem to love it. The summer festival may shift in certain ways, but it is our delivery method for that mission that has continued now for over 40 years.
Now, at this point in time, the Playhouse is no longer the Intimon Playhouse. I don't know the official name. It's Cornish has taken it over.
Yes,
Cornish College
Cornish
of the
Playhouse
Arts
at Seattle Center.
So, does Intimon have a physical home through the 10 other months of
the
year?
We are not homeless. We are not not wayward. We have shelter and food and water. Yes, 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 yes. We our offices are at the Cornish Playhouse all year round. Our administrative offices.
Oh, you get to stay there.
Oh yes, we are paying residents. We are totally yes, we get to stay there, and we then rent from them for the 4 months that we have the festival time there, and it's a completely healthy arrangement. We're thrilled to be partnering with them, and thrilled that we get to keep telling important stories to this community.
What about the outstanding debt that the theater was carrying?
Well, it's 50% of what it was when the theater closed, and we have plans in the next 2 years to completely eliminate it. We're really proud about that, and everything seems to be going in that direction.
Is that separate fundraising from whatever money you might raise through ticket sales for the festival?
It's a little more complicated than that. It is every year has a line item that is devoted to the negotiation of our past debt. And so it's part of it. We just completed a five-year plan with some consultants and with our board, and it's completely layered into that, so that hopefully in the next 2 years it's eliminated.
You can not see him twitching while I ask about money, listeners.
Well, I mean, the reason I'm not really twitching.
No, he's just shaking.
No, you're making it sound so dramatic. No, what I will share is that last year was really about building a structure. In a way, it was about, you know, building a church. And this year is about what's inside the church. What is the sermon? What are we all going to sing about? And so it's an honor to have people like Jane Nichols, Sheila Daniels, Valerie Curtis Newton telling important stories. The structure is important, Marcy, I agree. But it's also, this summer is very fun. And I would love to see as many folks come out and see it.
Now, Jane Nichols, as Andrew just reeled off, three of the four directors this year are women, which is not always the case at any theater company, bit large or small. So is there a certain tone that's set by having two plays that are about strong women and having strong women lead the direction of three of the plays?
Oh, I don't know how to respond to that because I am a woman, and I consider most women strong. Men's theater is just as interesting to me as women-directed theater.
Well, I'll ask you, Andrew, was it intentional that you chose three women to direct, or did it just so happen?
It was not. I'm very proud of it. It was not intentional. We wanted the best that could direct the work that we were building. And in many cases, the projects were driven by the individuals involved. What is fun, and I remember noticing this, Jane, on our first preview, is that at each point, all directors are present to give feedback. So, you know, normally mm-hmm. you have one artistic director coming and saying, here's the things you need fixed. Whereas after each of our previews, it's been four individuals talking about what they just saw, what could fix it, and therefore what can happen overnight is pretty remarkable.
There's a great spirit of collaboration in this festival, but I think it's largely due to the male who's the head of all this, namely Andrew, because Andrew invites an openness of spirit and a generosity and an enthusiasm. I think it would happen if we were all men or women.
So your show premieres officially on Saturday night.
Yes.
I think you're the kickoff play, but you guys have been performing these for a couple of weeks for audiences.
No, we've had one preview
That's it.
A couple of weeks ago, and then the actors the very next day were back on the stage and rehearsing. I think at that point it was Trouble in Mind, and then Stu, and now Liz Estrada. So tonight will be our second preview. And Wednesday will be Friday will be our third preview, and then we have our opening. So, no, we have not been running.
So are things likely to change between tonight and the official opening on Saturday?
Sure. And they'll change. I will tell you that with this cast, if you came on a Saturday and came back on a Wednesday, you would see a slightly different show because the actors are just playing with each other and playing with the audience. An audience can shift a performance as well, especially in comedy.
And I know Andrew always is telling people last year to come early and come often. So I'm assuming that you'd say the same thing this year.
Totally. I mean, they will change right through closing and Therefore, I truly, you know, I my job is to see all of the shows, and every night, like a giddy schoolboy, I get to go see the work of three individuals who, yes, are collaborators, but are true mentors and masters at what they do. Each director is directing something that they were made to do, and it's not really an assignment. It is a joy and a pleasure. So come. Maybe I'll see you there.
He'll be there. Andrew Russell, Artistic Director of Intimon Theater. Jane Nichols directs the Intimon production of We Won't Pay, We Won't Pay by Dario Fo. It's one of the four plays Intimon's offering in the Summer Festival, which kicks off officially Saturday night, and the plays run in repertory through August 28th. And you can find out more.
They actually run through September 15th.
They do?
Yeah.
Wow. So it's a three-month-ish festival.
Yeah, it's longer. There's 77 performances total. Intimon.org. That was good, right?
Yeah, it was. Excellent. Thank you, both of you, for coming in. This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman.
In a minute here, a conversation with Jonathan Poneman of Sub Pop Records.
KUOW and Green Stage present the 13th Annual Seattle Outdoor Theater Festival, July 13th and 14th at Volunteer Park. 2 days, 8 local theater companies, and 15 different performances of outdoor theater. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
Jacob Brackish is the toughest, meanest teacher at Gloucester High School.
Don't you ever pay attention, Kathleen!
Now, he's forced to depend on the care of a woman he flunked years before.
I'm going to keep you alive until you apologize to us all.
Jason Robards and Judith Ivy star in Park Your Car in Harvard Yard. Next time on LA Theater Works.
Tomorrow night at 10 o'clock on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. 58 degrees in Seattle this morning. It's mostly cloudy. Forecast says it's going to turn partly sunny this afternoon, and we should get up into the low 70s. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy all day with a high of 74. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:38. Facebook is well known for making changes that create privacy concerns for its users. The latest in 25 minutes.
From KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. It's a little bit hard to believe, but it's true. Sub Pop Records is now a quarter of a century old, an official adult. It seems like almost yesterday when former Olympia Music maven Bruce Pavitt and musician and KCMU DJ Jonathan Poneman started a maverick record label here. Sub Pop since then has had its share of ups and downs, but it's walked through the coals and emerged to full adulthood and plans to celebrate this weekend, actually starting today. Co-founder John Poneman is with us today. It's great to have you in the studio.
Thank you, Marcy. Great to be here.
I have to say, when you look up Sub Pop's history online, there are many start dates that predate 25 years, you know, goes back into the 80s. So what is the date that you count that makes Sub Pop official?
Well, Sub Pop existed before 1988. Bruce Pavitt actually founded the label as a label in 1986. But we started having anniversary parties about 3 or 4 years into our existence. And when I refer to it as our existence, I'm talking about a start date of April Fool's Day, 1988, which is when we rented our first office and went into business full time. And when we started the anniversary parties, we used that date as, you know, the year zero, as it were, the beginning. And that takes us up to the year that we are now. What year is it?
2013,
that's right. So it's 25 years later, and we decided to seize on this opportunity to throw a big party in a neighborhood that we love, Georgetown, in a city that we love even more, Seattle, Washington, with consumers, friends, family that we love most of all.
Well, the first official recording, because Bruce did release recordings that were called Sub Pop before this, I believe was Mudhoney's Touch Me, I'm Sick.
No, the very first Sub Pop recording was a record called Sub Pop 100, which came out in 1986. And I interviewed Bruce over on then radio station KCMU, and we became buddies. Then he released a record called Dry as a Bone by a band called Green River, and that came out in 1987. And then we worked together on a Soundgarden EP, and then shortly thereafter we went into business on a full-time basis, and it was then that Touch Me, I'm Sick came out.
I'm only asking because you're wearing your Mudhoney shirt. People can't see you, but it is quite lovely. So I thought it must commemorate something. But it gives me
sartorial elegance.
It gives me a chance to play a little bit of Mudhoney on KUOW. This is Touch Me, I'm Sick. Now, I have to tell you that when I play this song, my 18-year-old son knows all the words, too. So this is a classic piece of music, I guess.
Being a Mudhoney fan is a rite of passage at this point. Kind of like a bar mitzvah.
I'm wondering how you guys chose the bands that you wanted to record in those days.
Well, we spent a lot of time in the clubs. And a lot of these people were colleagues of ours, both in the workplace and at the aforementioned KCMU. And they were doing great things, playing, you know, in interesting venues. There was an all-ages club called the Metropolis down in the Pioneer Square area that was crucial in the formation of what became known as the Seattle scene. And a lot of people hung out down there, myself included, the Gorilla Gardens being another venue. So that's is very natural.
Somebody, and I can't remember what article I was reading, said, oh, yeah, you know, Sub Pop was critical in developing the Seattle sound. So did that mean anything to you at the time? Was there a sound that you guys were interested in putting on vinyl?
Well, we were interested in the decentralization of pop music culture, of culture in general. Before the internet, there was hubs of activity, usually centered in particular regions, and a lot of them had to do with the natural gravitation towards Los Angeles, New York, in the case of the music industry, Nashville. But there were a lot of interesting phenomena happening outside of those predictable regions. The most interesting at the time, in the mid to late 80s, for us at least, was happening in our own backyard of Seattle.
You didn't have a lot of working capital, did you?
I broke a couple of piggy banks in order to get things going, yes.
So how did you make these records and actually get them into the hand? Because they were records in those days, tapes and records. How did you, there was no internet, so how did you get them into the hands of fans?
Well, my brother gave me some advice early on, and it was seen by Bruce and myself as being kind of naive, but it actually ended up working. Which is that we picked up the phone and started calling independent retailers across the country and selling the records COD. And they were limited edition records by bands that were getting a lot of attention in the, you know, the underground, as it were, and underground media. And so there was some inherent value there. And we took those COD payments and kind of use it as a lifeline to get through.
Now, I want to play another song that was an early recording by a band that actually brought you cash eventually. This is a song called Love Buzz. I'm not sure if that's the first recording that you guys put out by Nirvana or not.
That was the first recording that we put out by Nirvana. It was a side of a limited edition single. It was the inaugurated our Singles Club series.
And did this wind up on the album Bleach?
It did indeed.
There's just something about this when I think about Touch Me, I'm Sick, which is just sort of the wild, hair-banging, sort of fuzzy guitar sound, and this, which is almost a pop sound. They're very distinct kinds of bands.
Oh, they are indeed. This song was actually the cover of a song by a band called Shocking Blue, who are most popular for a song called Venus.
Mm-hmm.
May remember if you're old enough to remember, which
you and I are.
A few of us are. They're from Holland, and but I think the definitive interpretation was by Nirvana.
What attracted you to this particular band?
I had received a demo tape by that was recorded by Jack and Dino of. It was Kurt's demo tape. There was no Nirvana at the time. It was Kurt, Chris, and a drummer named Dale Crover, who plays with a group called the Melvins, another legendary Washingtonian band, Washington band. Anyway, when I listened to the demo the first time, I just was struck by the emotional quality in the voice and the versatility. And the songwriting, while it wasn't as developed as it would later become, was still quite evidently brilliant. So that was it.
Hmm. You know, you guys went up and down. A band's left. You ultimately sold part of the company. I think that kept you in business to where you are
now.
Oh,
yes. It definitely kept us in business.
But you also, if you evolve business-wise, you also evolved, I guess, sonically, if that's the right word. The kinds of bands that people most identify with Sub Pop and its roots are just a very small sector of the kind of music I think that you like and the kind of music that's found its way onto the label over the years. These days, your catalog goes from hip hop to a sort of much folkier sound. I remember you sending me Iron and Wine, which is a guy from Florida, and you thought, Marcy, you're going to like this. I don't even remember how many years ago you sent me that CD.
It was a while ago, yes, indeed.
And a really different kind of sound than the sort of rock that you were identified with.
Well, I think particularly in an age of streaming culture, when, you know, so much music is available at one's fingertips, a label's responsibility is, well, it's not really a label's responsibility, but if a label wants to be able to keep current with technology, it should be as versatile as the listener. And so I think all of us, if we look in our record collections, those of us who still have them, we'll see that, you know, it's rarely one kind of music. There's usually bits of different kinds of styles. And, you know, basically Sub Pop approaches the roster much like a consumer would approach buying records. You know, it's the things that move us, the songs that are memorable, the artists who resonate. And We try to approach it as best we can from the heart and from the ears.
Who makes the artistic final decisions over there?
Me.
Is that true?
No.
Oh.
I mean, I'm not going to pretend that I don't have a big say, but I've worked very hard. We have all worked very hard to foster a collaborative environment at the company. And as far as final say goes, well, sure, I guess I have it. But we really try to work in a way that allows for other people to have their voices heard.
I imagine you and I are sitting around a sort of pear-shaped big table, and I always am, and I've been to visit Sub Pop. There are rooms with big tables, and I imagine, and I may be totally off base, that you sit around and you know, you're like, hey, this band, and you play a bit of it, you know, what do you think? Thumbs up, thumbs down. Does it work that way?
Sort of. I mean, there's music being played all the time in the office. We have a what is called an A&R. The term stands for Artists in Repertoire, an A&R group where we sit and actually formally discuss the artists who are on the roster and who we intend to be on the roster. And, you know, the activities that they're engaged in and plans forthcoming for them. But it's actually the music is more of a conversation at Sub Pop. It's not, you know, the process is conversational, I guess I should say.
Who are you most proud of having signed to the label?
Marcy, come on.
Which is your favorite child, John?
Exactly.
Who do you love more than anybody else? You're not going to answer that question, are you?
I am proud of every single artist that I've signed to the label.
And how many are there now? Do you have a count?
Billions and billions.
Billions and billions. I mean, since 25 years, in a quarter of a century, I like saying it that way because it sounds so much more institutional than 25 years.
Silver Jubilee.
Silver Jubilee, yeah, sort of like the Queen of England.
Sort of
like that. The business itself has changed a lot. You know, people don't necessarily buy music. When they do, it's a 99-cent download often instead of a CD. And it seems that, in a sense, you guys have worked some kind of miracle to be able to stay alive where businesses have come and gone.
Well, I don't really see it that way, personally. You know, the music industry is changing, but, you know, our world is changing. And I think as long as you can be adaptable and recognize the trends and embrace them and consider the monetization and consider the application and the adaptability in the marketplace and proceed in an intelligent manner, then one should be fine. But the other thing, most crucially, is it all comes down to the music and a song or songs or a voice or, you know, an arrangement. You know, the process of relating to music is something that I think is very fundamental for all of us.
Jonathan Poneman is co-founder of Sub Pop Records, and the label will celebrate 25 years in business starting at 5 this evening, well, actually all day, starting at 11 on KEXP, the radio station formerly known as KCMU. Mudhoney is going to be standing on the top of, with some other bands, on top of the Space Needle playing. That's going to be live on KEXP. And then Georgetown Neighborhood, there's comedy shows, and you can find out more at Sub Pop's website. And you mentioned music that touches you. This is a song on your label that touches me. This is Down in the Valley, the Head and the Heart, here on KUOW.
Wish I was a slave to an age-old trade, like riding around on rail cars and working long days. Lord, have mercy on my rough and rowdy ways. Lord, have mercy on my rough and rowdy ways. Call it one drink too many, call it pride of a man. Don't make no difference if you sit or you stand, 'cause they both end in trouble and start to grin. Yeah, they both end in trouble and start to grin. You do it all. down in the valley with whiskey rivers. These are the places you will find me hiding. These are the places I will always go. These are the places I will always go. I am on my way, I am on my way. I am on my way back to where I started.
A song called Down in the Valley by The Head and the Heart, and John Poneman, co-founder of Sub Pop, just told me they've got a new album coming out on Sub Pop in October, so stay tuned for that. And now, the sound of the day. It's outer space. No, it is a silent symphony. Our listener Micah sent us that sound. He studies leafhopper communications, and he set up his recording equipment in the grass one day where he captured this sound. The insects that live on grass tap and drum the leaves or the stems they're on to transmit vibratory signals to other insects. Wow, their communications isn't loud enough for the human ear to detect, so what you're hearing is a signal that Micah's vibration recording equipment picked up. Woo, very cool. We need more sounds. That's in capital letters from our producers. What are you listening to that you are interested in? Record 30 seconds of the sound and send it to us along.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.